Hold on a minute, buddy boy. You got your walls. That's a flat latex. It's a flat latex paint. You want the semi-gloss on the trim. It's different paint. It's a semi-gloss, and it's completely different. That's a whole nother job, and you never said that. You said you wanted the walls painted. You know, you and your wife, you're kind of young. I kind of get that. Stick with me, because I'm going to take care of you.
Welcome to Command Control Power, a weekly podcast hosted by three certified members of the Apple Consultants Network, drawing from nearly half a century of combined experience. We talk shop, interview vendors and colleagues, and share what we've learned while operating our technology consulting practices. This is Joe Saponari of CIMAC, and my two co-hosts are Jerry Zygmunt of MacWorks and Sam Valencia of the HCS Technology Group. We also offer a weekly email newsletter, which includes show notes for each episode. Learn more at commandcontrolpower.com. And thanks for listening. This episode of Command Control Power is brought to you commercial-free and is made possible by our Patreon sponsors. You can help bring more commercial-free episodes by going to patreon.com/cmdctrlpwr and supporting the show with a monthly pledge. Thank you for your support of Command Control Power.
So we got the whole band back together this week, guys. Good to talk to y'all.
Oh, man. Let's just play our hits tonight, okay?
Give the crowd what they want, you know.
None of the songs from the new album, just the hits that they want to hear.
We now join the conversation already in progress.
Apple with the last wave of MacBook Pros, there's no more solid state drive that you can remove. It's soldered onto the motherboard, so there's no solid state upgrades. Basically buy the drive size and you have to live with it. But there used to be a little hidden port that Apple could use to try to extract the data if in fact you had some sort of a logic board failure. And that port has been removed because now the T2 chip is in place to give you this security enclave. I don't know if I'm using the right terminology, but now they're saying you have even less of a chance of recovering your data if you have a logic board failure.
Or basically what? Almost no chance. I mean, if your logic board has failed in such a way that it can't be repaired on a component level, you're either going to have to remove the SSD from the logic board. Might as well hand over, you know, your house and your firstborn to drive savers. If you're talking about removing components from a logic board and then doing a data recovery, I think forget it. It's probably just physically not possible. The T2 is now the controller for the SSD. It's kind of like a single functioning unit. If you don't have the T2 on that logic board controlling that SSD or those SSDs, as the case may be, you don't have the ability to access the data, right? It's inherently encrypted. And I think the controller, you know, on the T2 is now sort of like part of that encryption stack. So it kind of makes sense that it actually would not be recoverable even if there were a port on there. So, I mean, I guess that means Apple's pretty confident it'll never screw up. You know, you'll never lose data, right? If you don't have any pathways to data recovery.
Well, I tell you, that's a scary proposition for all the amount of people that are, I'm not even talking about businesses, but just the home users that don't think about backup. I mean, that's a conversation that doesn't need to be revisited, but think about it. So many people still don't back up. And if we're talking about the fact that it would be that much harder or near impossible to recover data without a backup, we could have some major issues coming down the pike.
Could you imagine those clients that really feel violated, you know, sometimes when they have a drive failure? We're luckily able to recover their data and we tell them that just escaped the guillotine. And now having a conversation with them, telling them, no, it's impossible for us to even try to recover this data. I mean, how outraged they will be in not necessarily a justified fashion because they don't have a backup. I would imagine there's a lot of people who will see headlines in the future, you know, Apple is responsible for me losing all the pictures of my baby.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, do you think that the Genius Bar will have flowchart of, you know, solutions to different problems for these machines? Like maybe you try a few things before you erase the computer, you know. I mean, in all seriousness, like, I mean, at least there were options to recover data before. But, you know, you walk out of the Apple store with a fresh out of the box MacBook Pro, newly erased by the Genius Bar to solve your problem. Yeah, there's no chance of recovering that data. So they might have to revisit those policies and really make sure that that's not going to happen to somebody without a backup. Because also, if it comes to that, maybe you can't even confirm the backup. You know, a lot of times you're going based on the client saying or the customer in the Apple store saying, yes, I have a backup. You know, yeah, it's all backed up, you know, and the asterisk to the cloud, which is not actually true. And So, I mean, if you're operating on the principle that you're asking the customer, is their data backed up? And if they say, yes, it's good enough for me, to your point, Jerry, I mean, they're going to be crying the next day in the Apple store, and that's not going to be good for Apple. So I wonder if ultimately this will be better for the Genius Bar policies and procedures.
I think if they had something in response to this, like, okay, we're going to release the new MacBook Pros, and basically if you have a logic board failure, there's no way for you to recover your data, but we're expanding iCloud to back up the entire Mac.
Great point. That's exactly my line of thought. Is like, and I think the other day, Joe, we had a conversation about this on the non-Jerry show that we were recording.
That's right.
But yeah, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Jerry. I totally cut you off.
No, that's absolutely it. You know, and that could be the way we would deal with our clients, whether they're business or residential customers, is we need you to subscribe to this service because we can't support you unless you do.
Exactly. I mean, that's part of your managed service offering anyway. I can't imagine a consultant having a client on any kind of retainer or whatever, not insisting on backups. I mean, we can't do our job unless we know for sure you're backed up. I mean, it's just can't have the level of peace of mind even interacting with those clients, you know, without knowing that it, ensuring that they're backed up and actually being responsible for it. So, yeah, I mean, that would be amazing if Apple offered an iCloud backup and it was like a checkbox in our tools we use to manage our clients, you know, and you could just like enable it remotely and then check the status. That would be great just to say, sign into iCloud and I'll do the rest.
Right.
You know?
Problem solved.
And I think, Sam, to your point, I think Jerry, you know, he secretly actually listened to the show. I know that you say, Jerry, you haven't listened to those shows yet that Sam and I did, but it's either that or we're way more on the same page than we thought we were.
Oh, for the last 14 days, I've had no place to listen to the show. To bring everybody up to speed, here at where I have a home-based office, we have a two-floor house, fairly small, just a little over 1,500 square feet, and it's all wooden floors. And we decided we were going to move everything out of the house, put it in a storage container, and bring the floors down to this, strip the wood completely down to bare wood. If you've ever been through this, you can feel my pain. It's just a mess. Every surface you could possibly imagine. They're very good at cleanup when they do these sandings and then the staining and then the putting polyurethane coats, but still there's just dust everywhere. The whole network was disabled and I didn't even have a place to sit down. And as it stands right now, I'm broadcasting from my lap. I'm basically sitting in one of the bedrooms here and I'm sitting in a chair and the Mac is on my lap and the microphone is on the Mac.
Well, at least you're on a chair, Jerry. I thought maybe you were on a milk crate or something.
I think we have a show title, by the way, Broadcasting from My Lap.
So, but we've moved back in and things are much better. And the one technological thing that came out of all of this is the place that we rented, because we actually had to vacate the house. We were out of the house for 6 days because you obviously there's no place for you to sleep and you can't sleep with the fumes, even if you could. So the home that we rented was equipped with Sonos speakers. I know, Joe, you recently had a little bit of friction with working with a Sonos system most recently. I'm sure we've all had contact with them before where we've either had to reset them or install them for a client. And I've always felt that it was a decent product. I'm into audio a little bit and I like the sound of the Sonos. I think for the sizes that you get, I think it's a good value. But I was really intrigued with the most recent wave of Sonos that have come out, where they've got Alexa integration. So that's the Amazon product. They've also embraced AirPlay 2. So there's AirPlay 2 functionality. So all your Apple devices, you have no problem now streaming everything out through Sonos. I broke down, spent the $200 and got a Sonos One because I loved the Sonos that we had in the rental house. And there were several of them. It wasn't the new version with Alexa. That sort of pushed me over the edge and got me to start working with this newer version of the Sonos. And it's great. So we got a little integration with Alexa. We can turn the thermostats up and down with our Nest. And it's much, much easier for you to play music than it's ever been before. So we were using Apple AirPlay, for instance, to stream our Apple music library. And also I could stream the FLAC library that I have, which is high-res files, high-res music from the Synology through the iTunes library. That did work to speakers using AirPlay. What's basically great about it is you could just say, Alexa, play songs by Neil Young, and it'll look at all the different libraries you have. So if you've got it hooked up to Pandora, it'll look at that. It'll look at Spotify. It'll look at Tidal. And it'll also look at your Apple library. So it's able to pull in from these different sources. And that's what I found so intriguing about it, was it was so open, such an open system.
My issue recently with a client, just because we hit a wall, you know, we've been down this road a bunch of times going way back years, you know, to where most people just had a single iTunes library and they had a couple of Sonos speakers and they wanted their Sonos controller or the Sonos app to be able to access the music that was in their iTunes library on their Mac. And so you just, you know, you run the Sonos software on the Mac and you just configure it to basically, you know, share your iTunes library. And it was always a little strange to me because what it would do is it didn't like talk to iTunes or anything. It would just basically look in the folder, pull out all the MP3s in there and list them, you know, and organize them in the Sonos app as your iTunes library. And the way it actually shared the music out from that Mac to the speakers or to the, you know, Sonos system was using SMB, you know, Windows file sharing service on the Mac going back years. And maybe they were kind of ahead of the curve there because, of course, now, as we know, Apple has picked SMB as the file sharing protocol going forward over AFP. Sonos still requires you to go through these steps to share your iTunes library from a Mac to your Sonos system. And it should be simple. You know, you go into the screen and the preferences where you can add a library, you know, in your music library settings, you can just add a folder. By default, one of the options is My Music Folder, you know, which is your iTunes library. So you'd select that. And in theory, what it would do is ask you for your administrator password and enable file sharing and configure it to share out that music folder. And it, what it's doing behind the scenes is it's sharing it by SMB, basically saving an entry in its database pointing to the location of that folder accessible over SMB. So it should be pretty simple. But in practice, what happened to us here is that we just keep bumping into this wall where we do all those steps and it just simply says Sonos was unable to add the music folder. And then it gives you the details, unable to add the shared folder. And then it quotes //Mac name/music, end quote, to your music library. And then the error number is 1002. And there's any number of references to this error online. And of course, there's a lot of possible solutions like, have you enabled Windows file sharing? You know, checking the name of your Mac, the name of the Wins net socket, all these different things you can try. And we just went, we tried everything and it just, none of it applied to us. We, you know, we tried the solutions nonetheless and could not get it to work no matter what we tried. Just keep bumping into the same error. So we eventually gave up. It just makes me wonder how much time is worth spending on this type of issue when these days there's way better options, you know, like you described, Jerry, just pull from all these other libraries.
Let me ask you this, Joe. I had been thinking about your issue and that path that you actually mentioned. It's a locally shared library. And of course, you're using the most recent up-to-date Sonos app. That path sounds a little bit off to me because in the screenshot that I believe I shared with you, it actually looked inside the particular user folder for the music. So I'm thinking, yeah, is it possible that even though you've reinstalled the Sonos app, that it's looking at an old plist, and maybe you need to do scorched earth and find anything having to do with Sonos and strip it out of the Mac and then start over?
You may be onto something, or it may be possible for me to just add a folder of my choosing and manually specify the path. So now that I've actually know I've got file sharing configured, I would test that. I didn't have another Mac on the network. I was connected remotely, but we could test, you know, do we have access to this Mac over SMB from, you know, from another Mac on the network or Windows PC for that matter? Can we connect? And then assuming we can, and we know that's working, we could maybe just add that path manually that we know work if it is in turn getting the wrong path. Because it looks different. You're right. I'm not sure why that is.
We've all been down that dirty, dusty road called SMB and SMB2
right,
with trying to get business scanners to talk to the Macs and create a scan folder that everybody could share and all this. And once you bring in these different variants that all these different workstation scanners, printers use, there have been problems in the past. I know why you found the connective tissue between that and possibly just this is an SMB issue, but I'm thinking it shouldn't be that hard. I think that path looks wrong to me.
I agree. It should not be this hard, especially since we're just following prompts. We're just selecting, you want to share your music folder? Great. Just select that option. So like we're not even putting in the path. It's just, that's the result. That's the resulting path. But you're right. I don't know where it's getting that computer name slash music. Whereas in your case, it's like it's a path to the music folder in the user's home folder. So it's like slash users slash your username slash music.
Right.
So it's a little confusing. So I don't know if anybody has been down that road before and tried all of the normal solutions and found some kind of creative solution to this or has any ideas. But of course, we're always open to listener feedback if anybody has any on this topic. Actually, speaking of listener feedback, I should mention our good friend from the Netherlands, Remy Kramers, got back to me about my Safari issue. So I had mentioned a few weeks ago that I have this issue where I minimize Safari windows to just revisit them later. And sometimes I'll click a link, you know, and I have a window that's open on screen that I'm actively using in Safari. And I'll click a link in Mail or Evernote or somewhere like that to a web page, and it opens up in Safari by default. And it will sometimes, I don't know if it's like 1 out of 10 or what, but it will just open in this minimized window. It resurrects my minimized window for whatever reason in favor of the active window that I'm actually using in Safari. And Remy's tip is you could actually make sure that the minimized window is a private browsing window, in which case it should not add tabs that way. Like it should prevent it from, if it does stumble into some code path that would cause it to try to add a tab to the minimized window. Supposedly, if it's a private browsing window, that may not happen. So it's a way of like mitigating this problem. A few other people had mentioned that they've seen this bug. So maybe that helps somebody else out there who's seeing it on a regular basis like I am.
It's a workaround, to be clear.
It's a workaround, right, yeah. Exactly. And also, to be clear, I have not tried it. So I can't say that it actually will work or won't work. But
yeah, that should work, though. I mean, it's a good workaround if you have no other options. Was it possible, and this might be oversimplifying your issue, the minimized window was the last active window that you were in? Or did you mention that when you talked about it in the previous show?
I'm not sure if I mentioned it. It is not the most recent active window. You know, I've been pretty confident. I mean, the first few times it happened, I thought, did I like just recently minimize that? Is some reason why thinks that that was the most recent one? And there are actual cases where this can happen. Like if you have a, you know, what we used to call modal dialog box on screen, if you're in Safari in your active window and you've clicked a link to select files from your computer and you've got like the file open window being displayed overlaying your active Safari window, I don't think you can open up a new tab manually in that case. You have to sort of like respond to that dialog in certain cases or maybe in all cases. And I think in those cases, clicking a link from somewhere else would also have the same result. It's going to avoid adding a tab to the window where there's a prompt for you to deal with. It's happened often enough where I've been absolutely sure at this point that, you know, neither of those things are the case. It's not my most recent active window, and it's not like I've got something up on screen in my active window that's like requiring my attention. You know, there just seems to be no good reason why it should avoid adding the tab to the place where I'm like actually working. But Jerry, I wanted to segue from you know, you mentioning some of the recent work that you have gone through in your home, and you know, or in some extent are still going through and putting finishing touches on, and it's been interesting to sort of follow the play by play as these projects always seem to get a little bit more involved and a little bit more complicated, a little bit more challenging than you kind of anticipated. You know, even as thorough as it may have been planned, things can get a little bit more difficult than you might have hoped for. And I had my own little experience with this when we were getting our condo ready to be able to vacate and take the show on the road, so to speak. Did some just very minimal sort of work. We had lived in the condo for, I don't know, 12 years or something. It's like less than half the size of your place. So really small space to, in theory, should not be a complicated job for someone to do. We wanted a few walls painted in the kitchen, some touch-up kind of work done, you know, to fix the corners of some of the walls. Just really simple stuff. And we kind of made a punch list, and we had a contractor come through. We found him on one of these apps like Nextdoor or one of those places where people will recommend workers. And he was very highly recommended. He was local. He came by to kind of scope it out and to give us an estimate. He seemed very fair. We decided to move forward with him. And like I said, it was very minimal stuff. And he said to us in this process, I don't work hourly. You know, that was like a point of pride. Like, I don't work hourly, as if it was a huge advantage to us that he wouldn't work hourly, where things can just get out of hand and you can just keep paying. It's another hour here, another hour there. The price goes up and up and up. It seemed to be like a huge benefit to work on a project-based methodology. It reminded me of, you know, managed services versus hourly billing. And I thought there were some parallels here. And I added it to our list to talk about it at some point. I thought, what better time to bring it up than when you're fresh out of your, you know, more major sort of home renovation project. I can now reflect on this, my much more minor home update project, and voice some of my frustration having gone through that, even in a very small way on my side. Project-based can not necessarily be to our advantage as the customer. And it's something that maybe we can draw some parallels to our businesses. So, for example, the pitfall that we found was that everything had to be very, very carefully specified, of course. And, you know, this might seem obvious to people, like if it's a project-based job, the project has to be fully scoped out and every little detail has to be basically accounted for and itemized, or, you know, your word against their word. You know, and you're basically just quibbling over details at some point if it's not specified in advance. And where this came to bite us was, you know, we had these walls painted in the kitchen, right? Proceeded to do the work one day, and I was at the office working, and he was finishing up and left, and I came by to check it out. And I saw that the trim, the molding or trim had not been painted. You know, very definitive. I mean, I've been living in the place for 12 years. You can tell that, you know, shoe scuff marks on the baseboard trim at the base of the wall that clearly were indicated was not painted. It was just very obvious. Like, you couldn't miss it. It wasn't like the contractor thought, oh, I've already painted that. It was just very obvious. And I brought that to his attention, like, you know, I'm just noticing that the trim wasn't painted. You know, and his response was something like, oh, you wanted the trim painted. And I was like, okay, I'm being played right now. I'm being had. You know, this is ridiculous. Like, what do you mean, did I want the trim painted? You know, I want the wall painted and the trim. Like, do I really need to specify the trim too? You know, you buy a car, you know, did you really want a steering wheel? I mean, come on. That was the prime example of really, like, I needed to specify trim. And maybe it speaks to the professionalism of the contractor I worked with, although he had a professional business going. I think it came down to the fact that he had hired, sort of subcontracted the work to somebody that he had doing some work for him. That person didn't do the detail work, you know, just didn't do the trim and kind of like winged it and just thought maybe he could get away with it, or he just forgot or thought he'd go back the next day, or I don't know what. The business owner, you know, the contractor that I hired, was a little bit weaselly about it, you know, didn't say, oh, I'm so sorry, like my guy, you know, I'll talk to him about it. Clearly that should have been done. You know, he did not own that kind of feedback and tell me that I wasn't crazy. Like, clearly that should have been done. He made it almost like I should have known better, that I should have specified that. So I don't know, Jerry, did you encounter any of this kind of thing in the work that you did? Or do you guys have any thoughts on like project based and where it can sometimes bite you as a customer?
Yeah, I mean, I guess in any business, there's contractors who can, if in fact, you know, it's project based, what's inclusive and what's not inclusive in the scope of work. And I would imagine when you tell people to do cosmetic painting and touch up, if the wall is scuffed, you get the wall. If the trim's scuffed, you get the trim. There's people who are going to try to add more additional work to the job and not make things as inclusive. It would be interesting to try to draw some parallels working in the tech world. Well, what would be a good analogy that would this would align with? In our particular case, I think because my wife and I have been involved in other sort of projects before, we didn't have a GC to do the work and then to sub out the other work. We basically brought in each journeyman to perform the tasks. After the floors were done, we had somebody come in and do the paint touch-up. We had a plumber come in, do some plumbing. It was all on a cost-plus basis. If we focus on our clients for a moment,
sometimes their perception of what's included in the project may be very different than what we think we're tackling. I think a lot of it boils down to when you come out with these project-based fees, are you being very specific about what is covered? When I developed our contract paperwork with David Sparks, and we were very specific about what was covered in jobs, either MSP contracts or specific jobs that we would tackle for the clients. Because to your point, Joe, that whole thing about the trim being excluded, which seems blatantly obvious to you, like, yeah, paint the wall and the trim. Like, I don't want the trim to look old in comparison to the wall that I just painted. If he had just listed that in like, here, your walls will be painted, but your trim will not be, and you have to sign here in order to get this done, then it would have been on you to actually do that. But I find, like, as Jerry was saying, also contractors in different fields may not have the same same level of depth of paperwork that we might in a technology-based field.
Oh, yeah. I mean, this guy was just doing everything by text message, basically. You know, it was kind of absurd almost. But I mean, to our credit, I mean, we haven't been through this really to this extent. As minimal as the work was, you know, we hadn't really been through something even of this, you know, magnitude, you know, of this scale.
You guys are amateurs.
We're amateurs. Thank you. Exactly. And so we didn't know, like, we needed to specify these things, but also to our credit, maybe to me, it seems really obvious, like you said, that you would paint the trim also with the walls. That's what painting a wall is. It's also painting the trim. It's not like we're painting like one wall. We're painting like all of these walls in this area. And therefore I thought it was like also all of the trim, of course, you know, it seemed like it was obvious. And for him to say paint walls, not including trim, that would have seemed almost absurd to me, that for if it had been specified like not trim, it would be like, OK, well, I see you're making me jump through a hoop to tell you that I want you to do the trim, obviously. Or better yet, let's put it this way. If you were of the quality that we thought, maybe he would have pointed out at that time, and what about this trim? Do you like want me to do the trim as well? Hey, you know, it's more business for him. Like, he should have really suggested it. So I thought it was a little bit disingenuous that he then retroactively tried to say, like, oh, you know, like, you didn't ask me to do that, basically. I think he was just a cop out, you know.
On top of that, with him subcontracting out the work, he's also now relying on the quality of the subcontractor. Maybe he was backing him up. You know how, like, sometimes if your guys may not do something that the client expected, but you're going to always back up your guy to kind of, I don't know, depending on the client. I'm wondering if he backtracked and went with that instead of like, I'm not going to throw my guy under the bus. I'm going to protect him here.
It's a good point. You know, that might have been a way to smooth it over a little bit, not blame anybody, but just say like, oh, okay, we didn't realize you wanted the trim. Made me feel a little silly, but it wasn't like there was a real blame aspect, you know, where, you know, he was going to say, you know, like, yeah, we really should have known that, or, oh, my guy must have forgot to do it. You're right. I mean, if the answer really was my guy forgot to do it, I guess I don't blame him for trying to help him save a little bit of face, you know. So
I'd still
I don't
be
know.
Pissed. Don't get me wrong.
Exactly. And, you know, then it became from there, okay, you want the trim done? Well, yeah. And like, then there were a few other little adjustments and things. And it wasn't just for the trim, but for other reasons, we're then talking about, well, it's going to be cost additional. And so then we're getting into like adjusting the scope of the project and, you know, additions and changes or something, where then there's a charge for these things. So now I'm paying more, but it's not really exactly clear like what that covers, because, you know, was the trim included originally or not? Are you doing me a favor by now doing the trim, but you're charging me for these other things and you're kind of making it up, you know, in that way? It started to get a little bit messy in that sense. So that was the other kind of aspect of billing out on a project basis, is that as soon as you start to make adjustments, pretty soon you're almost like back to hourly. You know, if you start to say like, well, you know, you wanted me to add this thing on, it takes me this much extra time, and therefore like it's going to cost you this much extra. I don't know. It kind of makes me think there's a beauty in just doing it hourly straight from the start.
Hold on a minute, buddy boy. You got your walls. That's a flat latex. It's a flat latex paint. You want the semi-gloss on the trim. It's different paint. It's a semi-gloss, and it's completely different. That's a whole nother job, and you never said that. You said you wanted the walls painted. You know, you and your wife, you're kind of young. I kind of get that. Stick with me, because I'm going to take care of you.
What you're saying, though, Joe, in all seriousness, I think we can make this correlation to what our customers perceive with a managed service. And like you say, maybe there is a beauty in not to be project-based and to be just what we called, you know, when we were in the manufacturing business, when I was in that years ago, we called it cost plus. It's just basically, it's going to cost you what it cost us. You know, this is our hourly rate. You know, we're going to charge you for materials, whatever it is, it is. Because I think you would have felt a little bit more satisfied at the end of the job. You know, it may have cost you more than you originally guessed at, but at least you wouldn't feel like you're somehow being chiseled, or he's somehow gouging you on some other service because he's trying to make up doing the trim for you now.
Right. Well, and I'll share a little bit more about why I think that I was sort of in the right in this case, although I do allow for the fact that I think could have done a better job of managing it from the start and identifying these things. But the other thing I walked into when I checked the quality of the work was that he had walked around and to the different walls. We had two different colors of paint that we wanted. On these walls, we wanted this lighter color. And on these other walls, we wanted this darker color. And he walked around the condo and used a pen for some reason. I mean, how often do you see like a painter using a pen? But anyway, this guy had just grabbed a pen and wrote on the wall to, like, you know, tell me like I'm five. Like, he wrote the word light on the wall so that his subcontractor would know, or that, you know, in theory, he would remember which wall I wanted the light color paint on, right? So you write with a blue ballpoint pen on a wall that's already a light color, and you write the word light on it, and you're painting a light color over it. I mean, you can kind of see where I'm going. So I walk in and I look at the wall. I'm like, yeah, it looks great. And I walk up close and I see the word light, you know, and I'm just like, really? Like, is that okay? Are you happy with that? Like, are you happy with the outcome here? Like, your pen is still visible. I don't, you know, did I have to specify, like, also don't make the pen show through? Like, is that set on me?
That's an extra charge.
Right. Paint where it says light also, please. Point well taken on the whole thing, but, you know, there's also an aspect where if you're not working with somebody of the level of professionalism and integrity and whatever else, and they're going to try to maybe just like skate by and get away with it, even more so, it's important to really be very clear from the outset on what's included and what's not. So that's my advice on the customer side. But, you know, from our consulting side, my resistance to doing a project-based thing or even managed services was having to put in all this work up front on scoping it out and specifying every little detail. So my question to you, Sam, is like, how much time do you spend when you're writing up a new MSP contract or some kind of project scope document, identifying all those little things? And have you ever gotten into a situation like this? I'm sure we all have, where you kind of wished you had put in even more time to make it sure it was 100% clear what was included and what was not included from the start.
Oh, heck yeah, man. I've made more mistakes than I can count, but that's part of what we do. On the MSP side, I got that pretty much locked down for the monthly numbers and what's covered, what's not covered. Every once in a while, we'll adjust it for clients here and there, but I have it locked down where I'm not going to let anything slip through the cracks, or at least nothing has. But with the projects, it's easier. You know, I'm sure you guys know when you do an email migration over and over and over again, it's easier to build that bullet point list of what needs to be done for those because you've had experience with those projects. The issue that I have that I'm sure others do is when you come across a new one, something you haven't had a lot of experience with, or you haven't done that type of scope of work before. And then you really got to think, what might I miss out of this that might screw me in the end, and it's going to cost me more time that I didn't account for? That's a concerning piece. I always have a sense of paranoia when I take on a project that's relatively new to me, that you never know. I mean, you could totally miss out on something, and then that's 3 hours down the drain that might be over scoped, and then you got to take that back to the client, be like, hey, this went a little bit higher than we expected. And of course, they're not going to be happy with you.
And then you try to maybe proactively negotiate with yourself to say, you know, this went over by 3 hours. Like, you know, let me try to get an hour or an hour and a half from the client. You know, hopefully they'll understand that they got a better value. My mistake. So I'm not going to ask them for the full amount. Oftentimes we're successful with that. I don't know how your clients are probably pretty reasonable in many cases.
Some of them. Yeah. Or I just won't pay my guy and that'll save me some money.
There you go. That always works. Yeah. For a mistake like leaving the pen mark on the wall, I mean, I think that there should be some restitution on his side too, you know, for making good on that. You know, if he had to have the guy come back and put another coat on or something, like, that's between them. They need to work something out where that's not going to happen again, you know, because nobody's happy in that kind of case. Okay. I had him come back. He took care of it. Here's the thing, too. It's like, because of the quality of work, just how bad it was to see like pen marks on the thing, there were other things that we would have had him come back a third or fourth time to do. But we're just kind of like, you know what? This is good enough. I don't want to see this guy again. Painting gray in one part, he dripped gray paint on the white trim that he finally, you know, did end up painting. And so there were like paint marks on the floor. There were paint marks on the trim. And I thought, like, you're a painter. This is your one job. You don't get paint on things, you know, like you put the paint where it's supposed to go, like not anywhere else, you know. He came back and he remedied those things. And there were other things that we just decided, like, you know what, I'm just, you know, we don't have time for this and it's good enough, basically. So,
yeah,
you know, live and learn also. But yeah, I think you said it, Sam, like you have to have experience. You have to go through these things and learn, like, what do I need to specify? What do I need to think about? Like, what are my assumptions? What do I know that I know? And what do I not know that I don't know? You know, and how do I mitigate that somehow? Right.
It makes me wonder, though, this guy seems like he had a lot of experience, at least from Jerry's impression of him. It sounded like he was, you know, well into many years of working in the business. It was unprofessional in a few ways. I just can't get over the light on the wall, you know, just writing the word.
I know.
I'm still kind of baffled.
I'm going to take a photo. Took a photo because I was like, this is ridiculous. I can put these in the show notes and people can just get a kick out of this. Yeah. It's like priceless. And the other thing was, okay, at the end of all this, he's asking us for a 5-star review. He left his card on the first day. We found it in a drawer and we took the card out of the drawer because he had to fix this drawer. So he left the card in the drawer. We took the card out and threw it away. And then when he came back to fix the work again, he left 2 more cards. So we're like, this guy doesn't give up.
Maybe he didn't see it the first time.
Yeah, right. Maybe they don't even realize how good I am. Hold on. Ashley has a comment here for the show. Hold on.
The very first thing he said when I reached out to him, he said, have you seen all of my 5-star reviews?
Right. So he's very obsessed with the review. So it's like his main concern is like, you know, I fixed that pen mark on the wall. Like, can you give me 5 stars? You know, like he was like very much like, can you review me with 5 stars? So I wanted to go on Google and give him a 5-star review and have like photo number one. Does this look like a 5-star job? You know, photo number two. Like, is this a 5-star quality right here? You know. Wow. Live and learn.
With tech work, there's a lot of gray area. So the client doesn't necessarily know if you're doing a good job or you're not doing a good job. Whereas when we're talking about home improvement, things are really obvious, like whether a wall was painted well, whether there's paint on the floor. Even if you have a general contractor, generally those guys are not on the job all the time and they go off the job and then they come back and they review the progress. And if you did it like we did, where it was just basically we hired out all the guys themselves, we have this one story. It happened to me last week where we had to get a new dishwasher. So the guy shows up to install the dishwasher before the plumber gets there. And so when you install a new dishwasher, you normally would turn off what are called the shutoffs, which is the water supply that goes to the dishwasher. Well, I looked underneath the cabinet. Now, this home was built in 13 years ago or redone 13 years ago. I didn't see any shutoffs. I found out much later that the shutoffs were also tied to the kitchen sink. So had I turned off the water for the kitchen sink, the water supply would have stopped for the dishwasher. The guy shows up. He said, I'm here to install the dishwasher. And I said, oh, okay, so you're not the plumber. And he said, no. Why? Do you need a plumber? I said, well, I'm not sure about the shutoffs. Let me find them for you. I said, no, I've looked, and we have no shutoffs. He said, well, you're going to have to turn off the main. So I go down to the basement. I turn off the main water supply to the house. He puts in the dishwasher, does a great job. He says, you're all set. And he's heading out to his truck. And I said to him, don't you want to do a water test? He said, no, I've been doing this for years. You're all set. And so he's sitting in his truck. I go downstairs. I turn on the water, and I come upstairs, and the water is literally gushing out underneath the cabinet and onto the new floors that we just had done.
Oh, my God.
Oh, man.
And instead of running downstairs to shut off the water, I see he's just about to pull away in his van. So I run out to the front lawn, and I'm like jumping up and down, and I'm like gesturing towards the house. And then I run back in the house, turn off the shutoff, and the guy comes up and he goes, oh, I thought you were going to have the plumber plummet. And I'm like, no. So he misunderstood from what I told him that I was going to have some shutoffs put in. And there actually are shutoffs because it's tied to the kitchen sink. And he just assumed, oh, I don't have to do the water hookup. So he left everything wide open. And when I turned on the water, everything just gushed out. So
he just shoved it in there.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah.
Right.
So you got to be there. I mean, that's another thing too. You got to be on site. If you're going to manage and be the GC for your work, you have to be there. And it's like with what we do in our tech business. A lot of times we really strive to get the best employees we possibly can, but there's always that role that we need to step up and play most of the time. And a lot of times it requires us to be on site. Not always.
That's a really good point. And just to be able to not only, if you can't be there, you know, not only trust what your guys, you know, your contractors or employees are saying, but also follow up with the client. You know, are you happy? How did things go? Do you have any feedback? Do you have any, you know, anything left to do? Any, you know, any unanswered questions? So we've been developing in the meantime our own kind of process, you know, how to prompt our employees to follow up with different things. Like if it's just me, you know, I know how I would do it. Any unanswered questions, that's not on the client. That's kind of on me to like follow up, either recommend a subsequent visit or to let them know that there's no answer just yet and to let us know if they still need help in a few months or something on that question. Any direction where my employees go rogue, so to speak, you know, something wasn't done according to our best practices. Maybe there are reasons for that to like actually address that, both from the employee side, checking in with the client to see if they're happy with the job. And if that person you hired, Jerry, was working for somebody and that person called you and said, you know, how did it go? And you filled them in that, well, aside from the flood in the kitchen, it was okay. Like, you know, that's a mistake that will hopefully never happen again. So it's good to kind of close that loop. But it also, it's surprising because, you know, we take pains in our business anyway to be really clear with clients. Like if I walk out and the backup is not set up and working and known to be successful, to me, I don't want to leave a client in that place. I want to make sure I take pains to make sure that they know that they need to do something or I need to do something or whatever to finish that job. If I were that person who installed the dishwasher, I would have said, and just to be 100% clear, when your plumber comes to install it or to plumb it, sure, whatever, you know, it just like you just mention it like one final time. Anything that you, you know, you think it's clear, but like you got to just say it, you know, right. And I think right, that's like the key thing. Yeah.
Your backup is not working until you get this replacement drive in, and then you could reach out to us and we'll make sure that you're backed up.
Exactly. And document it furthermore by email, you know, sure, mention it one final time because you really want them to know, but also you want to cover your own butt and mention it by email so it's on the record also now, with something like
and
that.
And I'm glad you brought this up. So there's a very fine line sometimes when you do follow up with a client, because sometimes you're inviting yourself to do something which they might perceive as air quotes warranted work. And your billable services have pretty much stopped. If it's a time and materials client, all of a sudden they've thought like, oh, there's a couple more questions I want to ask him. And since he's engaging me and asking me how things went, I can not necessarily looking to extract more value out of you, but just in the course of engaging them in more dialogue, you're opening the door for them to possibly right, squeeze more work out of you that may not get paid for. So there's always that fine line. You know that the client's been satisfied, you know that everything's working, and you drive away and you don't want to get that call.
It's a good point. I mean, there's always the risk that, you know, while I have you, you know, you open sure, up that kind of aspect. But it, I have to say, like, the thing that saves me in my case is it, going back to the idea that I can always say to them, you know, let me know if this doesn't answer your question, we can schedule a remote. And for me, it's even easier because I can hide behind our operations manager, Judy, and say, Judy can help schedule a remote. And then I can kind of hand it over. And part of the process of scheduling, they get the form letter confirming the appointment that also links to our rates, you know, if there, in case there's any doubt, by kind of handing it off to like, quote unquote, scheduling process. It makes it a little bit clear that we're now going beyond that follow up, you know, how's everything going, to like, you know, helping with new questions, or even if they're like follow-up questions from that first appointment. Clients have to realize, like, if you were there and you were answering all these questions all as part of that same appointment, the charge would have been higher then, you know, that would have been all part of that longer appointment initially. So it's not like been there for an hour and now they can ask you two more hours of questions. It's all billable no matter how you look at it. Right. So I think it's fair game to open that up, and you just have to then be willing to push back a little bit if it starts to seem like they're asking, and some clients outright ask, you know, is this, I don't think I should be charged, or, and those are the ones that get charged, by the way, the ones that think that they can say that they don't yeah, think they should be, you know, charged for it.
Well, if you weren't before, now I'm charging you, buddy.
Yeah, now you're definitely getting charged, right? You removed any doubt by asking.